Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, August 26, 2016. Have you discovered the alt-right?
I love going on the internet because you get to see how like crazy people are. There's all kinds of perverts and all kinds of like, you know, all like racists and that type of shit. Like, no matter what, like, you go into a chat room, within 2 seconds, it ends up, you just see these unbelievable back and forth. People just going off on each other, you know, someone writes something fucked up. I saw one night, some white dude wrote something fucked up, and then this black dude writes, he goes, you guys are just mad because, you know, the black guys are out there fucking all the white women. And then he writes, and you know it's true. And he wrote it in capital letters. And he underlined it. So evidently, not only was this guy yelling, he was like standing on his computer's chair, like screaming, and you know it's true.
That's comedian Bill Burr. And the internet does, of course, have a lot of lively characters. And there is a lot of hate speech that circulates on the web, not only in the United States. And yesterday, in a broadside against the Trump campaign, and in part a guilt by association attack, because of Steve Bannon's new role in the Trump effort, Hillary Clinton unloaded and gave a real nasty speech in Reno, Nevada, attacking Donald Trump. Now, much of what she said is accurate and well-placed. I'm not disputing what she had to say, but tactically, this was an effort on the part of Hillary Clinton to deflect attention from the scandals of the Clinton Foundation and the State Department emails that helped expose the Foundation issues, and to get people to focus on the fear and danger posed by Donald Trump. Now, Trump returned fire, calling Hillary a racist, and all kinds of other slimy attacks. And he is trying to distract from his waffling, shifting, spinning, flip-flopping on immigration. Oh, he's still going to build the wall, but will people be deported, or will they just have to touch base in their home country? And it's really convoluted at this point, as Trump is trying clearly to soften his image, but it's really just confusing his base voters. And so Hillary Clinton says that Donald Trump is, linking up to the alt-right, that he embraces an emerging racist ideology, that Donald Trump has a long history of racial discrimination. He promoted the racist lie that President Obama isn't really an American citizen. He retweets white supremacists online. His campaign has been a steady stream of bigotry. And all this, I believe, is accurate. But this broadside at this moment, as I say, is attempting to deflect attention. And I think it worked, at least for one news cycle. We'll see if this is going to be able to blow the Clinton Foundation issues out of the focus of the corporate media in this country. And what I found fascinating is, for example, here's an article in today's New York Times, headlined, Hillary Clinton denounces the alt-right, and the alt-right is thrilled. And this is one of the risks you take when you try to demonize an opponent, because many of the attacks on Donald Trump not only are deflected by his own kind of Teflon, but the more you attack, the more you strengthen the support of the people who are in his camp. And this is one of the kind of convoluted or counterintuitive dynamics in this year's bizarre presidential campaign. And so you've got these white supremacists saying, thanks for the free PR, Hillary. The alt-right will long remember the day you helped us make it into the real right. And it is true that to some extent, she is giving them cred just by attacking them. Now, what I find interesting is to watch the mainstream corporate media in this country and how they respond. As you may know, I force myself every night to watch the PBS NewsHour. It gives me the Beltway perspective. It's a very safe news program. They do give longer time lengths to the stories that they cover in many cases, and I appreciate that. But it's often to provide more insider perspectives. And very rarely do you see real progressives permitted to come on the show and comment. So last night on the NewsHour, as they tried to explain to their viewers, whom they assume are completely ignorant of the alt-right, one of the guests they trotted out was Matthew Continetti. Now, Continetti is a rising star in the establishment Republican conservative media world. He married into the Bill Kristol family, and he is a staff writer at the Weekly Standard. Now, it's fair to say that the Weekly Standard, along with the New Republic, has been a thorn in the side of Donald Trump and his rise in the past year. But we have to look beyond that one-year time horizon and note that the Weekly Standard and its ilk have fueled and greased the rise of the extreme alt-right voices that they are now kind of poo-pooing and politely saying, oh, they're so radical, they're so far out there. But when you trace the trajectory back to Rush Limbaugh, who launched in 1989, and the damage that he has done with one-sided commentary and a whole lot of fabrication. And he escapes notice in this current world because we have more extreme people out there in the so-called alt-right. And while the commentary correctly notes that the Breitbart news site has been run by this guy Steve Bannon since Andrew Breitbart died, they don't really trace the history of the Breitbart site and the smears that took down Acorn with the complicity of the Democrats in this country, the scurrilous videos selectively edited by James O'Keefe and pushed out by Breitbart. And so when you look at the history here, the corporate media is permitting the right-wing establishment to wriggle out of any responsibility for what is fair to say more extreme commentary, but that was enabled by the big money interests who have driven the Republican media, including Fox News, and I should have mentioned them earlier, for over 20 years now. And so what we're seeing is the cumulative effect of right-wing messaging. And so now I'm looking at a story here published by Vice News today. Headline reads, Why Hillary Clinton is Talking About the Fringe Alt-Right Movement. And in this article, they recap some of the right-wing outlets and players, like over at Breitbart, the tech editor, Milo, is it Yiannopoulos? Yiannopoulos is his name. He apparently is a gay man who dresses like Macklemore. Okay. And then they include Alex Jones. And I am no fan of Alex Jones. He's described here as uber-libertarian and Sandy Hook and 9/11 truther Alex Jones, who runs the sovereign citizen-style news network Infowars.com. Now, I don't pay much attention to Alex Jones, the reports of his that I see are sent to me by third parties, and I've never embraced his style or his coverage. But on the issue of Sandy Hook, there are legitimate questions to be raised. I've never gone so far as to say that the students reported dead were, portrayed by actors. And I don't claim that Sandy Hook didn't occur. My criticism is that the real-time live coverage of the event produced many contradictions to the official narrative that was later produced. And that's much my same complaint about 9/11. So to the extent that Alex Jones and I have some areas of agreement, well, that happens. But I also don't consider him a part of the alt-right. He's a screamer, a sensationalist. Yeah, he trades on some phony conspiracy theories and explores some what I consider to be legitimate conspiracy theories. But I don't think Alex Jones is a racist. I don't think he's a white nationalist. At least I'm not aware if he holds those views. Then they include Roger Stone, the one-time Nixon dirty trickster who's been a close Trump advisor. And through a third party, I've been offered access to Roger Stone. But I'm not interested. He can rave on and rave on as much as he wants. So now we see dirt on Steve Bannon. All right, Journalists have investigated. He is registered to vote in Florida at an empty house where he doesn't live, which is a violation of state election laws. And then we go deep into the past of Steve Bannon to learn that 20 years ago, when he was married, she accused him of grabbing her by the neck violently, destroying a telephone when he tried to call police. This was on New Year's Day, 1996, so that's 20-plus years ago. And it appears to be true, but I'm always skeptical of these kinds of things that surface, because a 20-year-old domestic violence case is something that you and I can't properly evaluate in the present day. And it happened to Alan Grayson in Florida. Now, I've been talking to Alan Grayson for many years. He was a member of Congress for 2 years. He lost the election. He came back and won re-election. And now he is running for the U.S. Senate seat in Florida, currently held by Marco Rubio. And about 2 weeks ago, information surfaced, and we saw Democratic leaders denounce Alan Grayson and support this former Republican, a rich guy who's pro-TPP, and he's bad on all the issues. His name is Patrick Murphy. And the establishment Democrats are all closing ranks around Patrick Murphy because they're claiming that Alan Grayson was an abusive husband. And I want to give credit here to Jordan Cheriton of the Young Turks, who recently interviewed Alan Grayson. And I also want to thank our listener who connected me up to this YouTube video, Jay Acton. I've linked to the video so you can watch the entire 24-minute interview at your leisure. But I'd like you to hear a few comments from Alan Grayson about the charges of domestic violence that have been leveled in this campaign and that I now consider a smear.
Yeah, sadly, in the midst of a rough divorce, which ended in annulment because my wife actually was married when at the time of our wedding, so she committed bigamy. After my lawyers had found the documents indicating that she was married to someone else at the time of our wedding, I went over to the house to pick up the mail. When I approached the front door, she left her car and punched me twice in the face. I backed away. Someone who was there videotaped it. She then called 911, and the operator said to her when she called 911, did he hit you? And she said, no, I pushed him. And then insanely, and that's not a word that I use lightly, but that's a fair description of this, she then filed a domestic violence complaint against me, even though the video clearly showed that she'd hit me twice in the face and I did not hit her. That's what we're talking about.
So he goes on to explain that this ex-wife had other issues. She torched a neighbor's car. She has claimed that her children have committed domestic violence against her. And I'm not going to get in the middle of their domestic issues here. But I am satisfied, based on this and the fact that no charges were ever filed, there's no court finding of guilt of Alan Grayson for domestic violence, this is an unfair smear, an attack that really is scandalous. And while Alan Grayson is not a perfect guy, okay, none of our elected leaders is, I respect him as a real progressive. A guy who is willing to put a little drama and theater into the political process in order to drive home a point. And I think Florida badly needs him. I mean, with Bill Nelson and Marco Rubio representing Florida in the Senate, you got nothing. They're both zeros. And Alan Grayson would make a great addition to the United States Senate. I know that that club doesn't want him as a member, and that's even more reason for Florida voters to support him in the primary coming up. I think it's on Monday or Tuesday. Meanwhile, I want to recommend a piece by Lee Fung published at The Intercept, again returning to my point that the corporate media is really living up to the moniker of liberal media that is often applied to it by right-wing critics. because the liberal people in the media who are closing ranks to support Hillary Clinton and to downplay the scandal at the Clinton Foundation, I find it really seamy. Because, you know, we're really seeing the true colors of people who claim to be progressive, people who claim to be fair, maybe not balanced. And so Li Feng singles out a few people over at Vox. Matthew Iglesias is saying, however many times they take a run at the Clinton Foundation, journalists don't come up with anything more scandalous than the revelation that maybe billionaire philanthropists have an easier time getting the State Department to look into their visa problems than an ordinary person would. Now, this is sheer rationalization. This is a diversion from the very serious issues that have arisen. Over at Think Progress, that's the media outlet of the Center for American Progress, run by John Podesta, the campaign chair for the Clinton presidential race. Well, you can't be surprised. Their editor, Adam Peck, says, aside from an occasional assist with acquiring a visa or meeting with executives from a cosmetic company, there were no shady dealings conducted at the Clinton Foundation. All right. Well, you have to ignore a lot of stinky stuff to make a comment like that. And over at Daily Kos, they are so in deep for Hillary. They ran a piece shared by the Blue Nation Review. That's the website that's owned by David Brock and supported by his super PAC. They claim that extensive reviews haven't found any evidence, that the Clinton Foundation affected a single action at the State Department. Well, that's because we don't have all the emails. That's because Hillary Clinton has not published her schedule for the final 2 years that she was at the State Department. And then they turn around and say, well, look, this is incomplete. It only covers 2 years. How can you make a conclusion based on that? That's how disingenuous these people are and their apologists. The Wall Street Journal found that Clinton made an unusual intervention to announce a legal settlement with UBS. The New York Times reported about the Russian company that assumed control of major uranium reserves and then kicked back $2.35 million to the Clinton Foundation. I mean, this list goes on and on. The deal with Morocco seems particularly shady, where the Moroccan government lobbied Clinton aggressively to influence her and others on the Moroccan military occupation of Western Sahara, which has the world's largest reserves of phosphate, which is a major source of export for Morocco. And Morocco donated big bucks to the Clinton Presidential Library, the foundation. They hired people associated with the Clinton political network. And they got what they wanted. And people have downplayed the case that I've been talking about for over a year, of Joe Wilson, whose wife, you know, you recall, Valerie Plame Wilson, was outed by Karl Rove's associates. Well, Joe Wilson cashed in on his connection with Hillary Clinton, got a $60-plus million grant from a State Department fund that she signed off on for a client who built a power plant in Tanzania. Hillary went to the ribbon cutting for that power plant. And so these are serious issues. And we are really seeing who the honest reporters and pundits are. And I'm frankly disappointed in Chris Hayes, who used to show some flashes of independence over at MSDNC, and now he's just one of the echo chamber chorus members. One more on Hillary, and I want to thank listener Linda Lewis, who tipped me off to this one. It's a report from CBS in St. Louis, Missouri. And they report that at the Army base Fort Leonard Wood, trainees are seeing a PowerPoint presentation about threats to security, threats to data and intelligence security. And in a PowerPoint slide that led with the header, "Who is the threat? Insiders." It then lists insiders like Hassan, the guy who shot up Fort Hood, I don't understand how he was leaking information. They also include Chelsea Manning, Ed Snowden, David Petraeus, and Hillary Clinton. So our military is training people that she is an insider threat because of her handling of secure information, the email server, etc. Well, the most unpopular woman in America continues to be Heather Bresch, the CEO of the drug company called Mylan. And not only is she trying to do damage control over the egregious price hikes of the EpiPen, the life-saving shot for people with serious allergies like nuts, you know what I mean. Well, it turns out that Heather Bresch got the job at Mylan Pharmaceuticals because her father was a pal of the founder of the company, Mylan Puskar. And her daddy, who's now a U.S. senator and was the governor of West Virginia at the time she attended the West Virginia University, well, his influence seemed to help her originally get a master's in business administration. But when she joined Mylan, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette just made a basic, you know, routine investigation, and they checked out her MBA. And when they contacted West Virginia University, a spokesman there said, well, she came up a little bit, a few bricks short of a load. So initially, the university told the newspaper that Bresch didn't have an MBA, but several days later insisted that she had earned one way back in 1998 and blamed the discrepancy on poor record keeping and later an unpaid fee. But when an investigation ensued, it was determined that she only had about half the credits needed for an MBA, and yet they awarded it to her because of political pressure. And after word spread that the administrators had awarded that degree to the governor's daughter that she hadn't earned, the dean, Provost Gerald Lang, and the business school dean, it's the president of the university, they all resigned in disgrace. But she feels no disgrace in jacking up the price. And what did she do? She increased her salary to something like $18 million a year as a result of this profiteering over emergency medical devices like the EpiPen. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. People like Cynthia Von Hendricks, Paul Tomaselli, Wendy Gebauer, and Abby McMillan. Thanks to each of you. And if you never hear your name here, chances are you need to open up a subscription. Then I'd be happy to mention your name, unless, of course, you prefer anonymity. We do have one subscriber in that category. All you got to do is go to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, and then you click on the pull-down, become a subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and it's easy. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month or $50 annual subscription. Hey, and I want to let you know, we still have tickets for the screening of Greg Palast's new movie, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, for my Bay Area listeners. The screening is at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland on September 7th, and I've given away one pair of tickets so far. I've got a dozen, so get in on the action. Just be sure to listen to the Greg Palast podcast, and you'll get all the details. We've been reporting on the ongoing aerial surveillance of the city of Baltimore. And the Baltimore Sun newspaper has done a great job of digging into how they managed to launch this program and keep it secret. And it turns out that the police department funded the operation of a fixed-wing aircraft and a contract with Persistent Surveillance Systems, the vendor, by laundering the money through the Baltimore Community Foundation. And the money came from a Texas, I don't know if he's a billionaire, but he's a rich guy, and he donated $120,000 to fund this pilot program of the aerial surveillance on a daily basis of Baltimore. And the funders are Texas, they are billionaires, Texas-based billionaire philanthropists Laura and John Arnold. And they put the money into the Baltimore Community Foundation, which didn't check on where the money came from. The community foundation includes former Mayor Kurt Schmoke, a guy I interviewed many times because of his progressive views on legalizing drugs. He said he didn't know about this, and he's going to look into it. And it looks like this may have been left over from former police chief Anthony Batts, who we know here on the West Coast because he was fired from the Oakland Police Department before he went to Baltimore. Earlier this week, I released an in-depth interview, and if you haven't had a chance to listen to it, may I recommend my conversation with NSA veterans Bill Binney and Kirk Wiebe. In the program, we discuss James Bamford's recent article regarding the hack of the NSA's hacking tools. And both Binney and Wiebe agree with Bamford that it wasn't likely Russia. It was likely not Ed Snowden. It was likely another internal leaker at NSA. And I'm proud to say that James Bamford listened to the interview and posted on Facebook that he was recommending it and that he was glad to hear that Binney and Wiebe essentially agree with his position. And one of the points that Bill Binney made in that conversation, when I asked him about the FBI's demand to hack the San Bernardino iPhone last year, he said that was all just a charade. The FBI either went to the NSA or perhaps to an Israeli vendor. And the phone was already open, Binney believes, before Comey made his big grandstand demanding that Apple open the phone for the FBI. So we're now learning that a company that is able to hack iPhones is based in Israel. It's called the NSO Group, and it was founded by former members of the Israeli military's NSA, which is called Unit 8200. And NSO made sales to governments which use the software. They say they don't operate it themselves. They just sell it to governments and insist that it can only be used in criminal investigations. Yeah, right. So this surfaced because a human rights activist in the United Arab Emirates, whose name is Mansour, what is his first name here? Ahmed Mansour. So he got a suspicious text message on his phone on the 10th of August, promising new secrets about detainees who've been tortured in jails in the UAE if he clicked on the link that was provided. But he was sufficiently suspicious that he sent it to Citizen Lab in Toronto. And at Citizen Lab, they said, "We recognize the links belonging to an exploit infrastructure connected to NSO Group, an Israel-based cyber war company that sells Pegasus, a government-exclusive lawful intercept spyware product. Once infected, Mansour's phone would have become a digital spy in his pocket, capable of employing his iPhone's camera and microphone. They could turn it on remotely and you wouldn't know. It can also record all of the calls, log messages sent into mobile chat apps, track his movements, pick up his contacts. You get the idea. It's total compromise." And on this story, the Wall Street Journal says that NSO reported it had been acquired by the private equity firm Francisco Partners for $110 million back in 2014. And the journal goes on to say, researchers highlighted the unusual way that Pegasus is installed on a phone, taking advantage of the three flaws in iOS, that's the operating system, to silently jailbreak the phone and circumvent the requirement that only Apple-approved software runs on the device. This type of one-click iPhone attack previously had been described by researchers, but had never been seen in a real-world attack. And this morning, Apple announced the release of a software update, iOS 9.3.5, and if you're running the beta of iOS 10, the latest seed of iOS 10 also patches those exploits. So if you want to tighten up your own personal security, you should update the operating system on your iPhone. Now to the perpetual war zone in Syria and Iraq, and it's really getting messy. We've explained that this week Joe Biden went to Istanbul, made a deal to sell out the Kurds in exchange for promises that are unreliable, that Turkey will be more active on the ground in Syria. Now, Turkey rolled some tanks into Syria, but their targets are not the Islamic State. They're not the Bashar al-Assad government. Their targets are Kurds. And so, in response, a Kurdish suicide bomber rammed an explosives-laden truck into a checkpoint near a police station in southeast Turkey today, killing at least 11 cops and wounding 78 other people. And this is direct blowback. And the U.S. now has responsibility because we have used the Kurds ruthlessly in the wars in Syria and Iraq for over 5 years now. They're the only reliable fighting forces there. In a New York Times op-ed today signed by Gonul Tol, the director of Middle East Institute's Center for Turkish Studies, Mr. or Ms. Tol asked some of the right questions about whether Turkey is a reliable ally for the United States in the assault on the Islamic State. But this goes into the category of fool me once and fool me twice, you know, shame on me, because it was a year ago that Obama made a deal with Erdogan that Turkey would get more involved in the war against the Islamic State. But it has been repeatedly hammering its own Kurds. And this op-ed, as I say, does spell out some of the issues, but then takes them in the wrong direction. And essentially, the writer argues that the U.S. should hand over Fethullah Gulen in exchange for Kurdish promises to fight this war on our behalf. And the writer says, Turkey's move into Syria carries a serious risk of mission creep. Turkey is not likely to withdraw if the Kurds fail to retreat to the east of the Euphrates, and the U.S. has ordered them to do so. If the Kurds do not back off, there's the real possibility of a serious clash between two of Washington's critical allies. The writer says the Kurdish militia remains Washington's best bet on the ground. But then the argument is presented that Washington needs to push the Turkish government for a return to peace talks with its own Kurds. But we have just given them a green light. We have not criticized them in any substantial way or penalized Erdogan for the attempted coup, which he may have orchestrated himself. We don't really know. And as the Times itself points out in the lead editorial on Friday, when Biden went there, he said nothing in public about the government's crackdown in the wake of this attempted coup. And the Times then gets honest. There are those who may have preferred that Mr. Biden say what most American officials really think, that Erdogan's roundup of coup plotters looks like an attempt to silence any opposition, that Turkey has behaved outrageously in failing to stop conspiracy theories depicting the United States as a co-conspirator in the coup attempt. Well, we don't know the reality of that. And that Turkey has produced little evidence to warrant Mr. Gulen's extradition, and that Erdogan's autocratic behavior is making him an unreliable ally. Now, that's a bill of particulars, I will say. But the U.S. has compromised itself, and I think that Turkey is going to really operate under its own agenda. And when Erdogan doesn't get what he wants from Washington, he's going to go to Moscow. It's a real dicey situation. And speaking of coups, now that the Olympics are over in Brazil, they are ratcheting up the impeachment proceedings against President Dilma Rousseff, who will face the impeachment trial on Monday. And it says she's going to lead her own defense. But it may not last long because the vote to remove her from office is expected to come as early as Tuesday night. That would be right at the end of August. And so far, out of 81 senators needed to remove her from office, they have 40... let me get this right. They have 48 senators committed to vote to remove her, and they need just six more to get to a supermajority of the 81 members in the Senate there in Brazil. And as you know, I don't believe that anyone in Brazil is... completely clear of corruption, including Dilma Rousseff. But the charges that have been presented are so flimsy, and they don't relate to the central corruption scandals of Petrobras and the car wash mess in Brazil. And so I do believe that this is a political coup. And I think that the United States is standing by and letting it happen. And finally today, we say farewell to a San Francisco, colorful, swashbuckling, gonzo journalist named Warren Hinkle, a larger-than-life character who featured an eye patch and always ran around with his dog Bentley, I interviewed Hinkle on a number of occasions, and he never let me down. He was always fun and had outrageous things to say. And Bentley was always by his side. And he was an old-style, hard-drinking, foul-mouthed guy. He had connections with Hunter Thompson. In fact, he gave a big break to Hunter Thompson, hiring him to cover the Kentucky Derby in 1970 for Scanlon's Monthly. And Warren Hinkle was also the editor of Ramparts for many years until it foundered due to financial problems. Warren Hinkle, thanks for being a part of San Francisco's history, and happy trails to you. Thanks for joining me for this news and comment podcast. You know what you can do. You can share it. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.